Lousy. Ed, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, I'm happy on this particular occasion, even though our internet connection is going to many other parts of the world world population, that here I see before me some old friends and people who were old friends, but I didn't know of it, of my generation. And therefore, as I speak before various audiences in particular, I will make that generation, my generation, a point of reference for the following reason. We, in my generation, had a particular experience, and there's no one older than us, generally, who's had that experience. And all of you, here in the room, or hearing by way of the webcast, internet, who've had that same experience as our generation. We were raised at the beginning under the reign of Coolidge and Hoover. It was a terrible time. Some people thought it was prosperity, but it was terrible. We were, as a nation, essentially immoral. This was the flapper era, the era of pleasure-seeking, the era of get-rich-quick and no particular morality. I know. I was aware. I lived there. The coolies spoke again. They heard you, man. Anyway. But then came 1928-29, and already in 1926-27, the farm belt in the United States began to collapse. Other people didn't care, but the farm belt was collapsing as a result of Coolidge's policies. And then came 29, and the great foolishness came to an end. And then we had the great Snow job then. Today we have John Snow as Treasury Secretary, who tells us that the economy is growing. The prospects are wonderful. Then we had pot in every chicken, or something of that sort. Two cars or two garages in every car, or something of that sort. Prosperity was just around the corner. And the poverty got worse and worse, and it became worse around the world, and people called it the Great Depression. Now, Hoover was not unintelligent, nor did he cause the Great Depression. But he succeeded in making it worse, for which he gets full credit. Franklin Roosevelt, who was then the governor of the state of New York, who was a descendant of a collaborator of Alexander Hamilton, Isaac Roosevelt, who headed a Bank of New York, which was allied with Hamilton against the traitor Aaron Burr. And Franklin Roosevelt maintained the tradition of that ancestor in the patriotic tradition of the founders of our nation. He prepared for his role as president by preparing the kinds of measures he would take to pull the nation out of this disaster, which was ongoing while he was governor. The Hoover administration tried to dictate to Roosevelt the terms on which he'd go into office, to impose on Roosevelt before he actually entered the presidency, to impose policies which, in a sense, would have been like what the something like the Bush policies of today. Roosevelt rejected that offer from Hoover, and the Hoover administration cut him off. So he walked into the White House without even a pencil in the inaugural address. And from that moment, however, he ordered the beginning of the recovery. of our economy. Today we face a similar situation. We've gone through a long period of idiocy, and I'll go through some of the experiences, starting from my experience and the experience of some of you in this room, to give you a sense of who you are, of whatever generation you are, whatever your age is. I can tell you who you are in the sense of who you are as a generation, what the experiences are, which over the course of the past century have struck you. You may not have experienced them in your flesh, but you experienced them transmitted from your parents, your grandparents, and so forth. And they're part of you. And if you understand what this experience is, what is part of you, passed down from one generation to the next, then you are better able to cope with the great crisis which faces us now, when we're in the worst financial monetary crisis of modern world history, which is now ongoing. Some of you, younger ones, have conditioned yourself to think that these conditions are bad but more or less normal, to think that these things that are going on now can continue, to think that there's an alternative for the next president of the United States, which is not me. And I shock you, there is no such alternative. And you're not going to find one. And I'll make it clear to you why. We, under Roosevelt, most of you my age remember, the United States turned up. We were gray-faced. You had people who had been on the bread lines for 2 or 3 years when Roosevelt came to power. I saw some of them. I saw their faces. Their faces had turned gray because they didn't know where they were going. They were more or less like the deep homeless of the United States today. No place to go home to. No future. Struggling from one day to the next. Many people like that. Take in this part of the world. Take the winter of 1932, which is a particularly cold winter. Many people who had had jobs and had homes earlier were surviving in hobo jungles. And it was a bitter cold winter, that 1932 winter, and people died in hobo jungles, which in those days were usually found alongside the railroad tracks someplace. Those were the conditions of life. And Roosevelt changed that in gradually infusing in the American people a sense of optimism that things were going to get better. Well, they got better slowly, but they got better. Then you had programs, public employment programs, and other programs which began to move things upward. By 1935, 1936, we had begun to become human again. We began to have some sense of confidence. 1938, after a slight recession that year, we became a little more confident. We then entered a war, which Roosevelt knew was coming. We participated in that war. We mobilized for that war. We were pre-mobilized for it. And we won that war. We won it not because we were the best soldiers in the world. We weren't. I was there. We weren't. But we had the best logistics in the world. And we won the war because we had the best logistics in the world. And the best logistics came from our farms and our factories and things like that. We were a great producer society. And when VE Day came, the day of peace in Europe, the world was happy and we were happy. And then came VJ Day, and we weren't so happy anymore. Thank you. Father by avoiding battles where they were not necessary, and using our air and naval power and other logistical superiority to dominate increasingly the entire Pacific region. You were able to bring Japan to the point with a blockade, a naval blockade, an aerial blockade, and the island nation Japan is dependent upon imports of raw materials and so forth from the continent of Asia, could no longer secure those imports. Japan was a defeated nation, not merely on the field of battle, but defeated by American logistics. Japan had already negotiated the attempt to surrender to the emperor, to the papacy, to the Vatican, to the Office of Extraordinary Affairs, of a gentleman then known as Cardinal Montini, or Montini Montini, later known as Pope Paul VI. That offer of surrender had been negotiated with Washington, but Truman refused to accept it. Instead, what Truman did is Truman took two nuclear bombs, which we had in our arsenal, the only two nuclear bombs we had in our arsenal, and he dropped those bombs on the civilian population of two Japan cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we weren't too happy when VJD came. We were glad the war was over, but the smell of victory had turned to a stink as a result of what happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We had done the unnecessary. Then when Japan surrendered under exactly the terms which had been negotiated through the Vatican before this happened. The occupation of Japan occurred under exactly the terms and conditions that had been planned and conceded by the Emperor of Japan prior to those bombs being dropped. There was never a need to do it. But that was not the end of the story. That was just a bad experience. The idea of this super weapon that could kill masses of people, a single weapon, so many, so terribly, all at once. You take the case of the Enola Gay, which is now going up in a museum outside Washington. The pilot went crazy with a sense of guilt over what they had done for dropping the bomb on Hiroshima. But it was worse, as I said. We had people like a man of peace called Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell was the inventor of the nuclear weapon. He admitted it. He was the one who started the nuclear weapons program in the United States. He was the one who planned nuclear preventive war to bring about world government. And that's why some of you of my generation were very unhappy about the end of the war. Because Winston Churchill came to Iowa and made a speech about the Iron Curtain. And we were then committed, in fact, under Truman, to prepare for conducting preventive nuclear war against the Soviet Union. And that continued. And Truman was a little man, very little in soul, in spirit, if any at all, made adventures against nations of the world, assuming that Russia and China would not fight back, because they were afraid of the nuclear weapons we didn't yet have, we were producing, but did not yet have. So they made a provocation against China. As a result of it, suddenly the North Korean army overran South Korea. The South Korean army was wiped out, later to be rebuilt, but wiped out then. And the American forces were trapped in a small perimeter at the tip, southern tip of Korea, in Busan. And then MacArthur outflanked the situation with the Incheon landing. It was on. And then Truman got rid of MacArthur. Because what Truman's policy was Russell's policy, to establish an Anglo-American world empire through the use of weapons so terrible that the world would submit to world government rather than face the deadly weapons of this type. And many of you who came back from military service at the end of war, who've been optimistic near the end of the war, because we knew we had won the war. We know we'd become a prosperous and powerful nation again. We had recovered from the effects of the Depression. Your optimism is spoiled because the FBI came sneaking around to find out if you really were ready to fight those commies and drop the bombs on them. One neighbor turned against another. Everybody was turning everybody else in. We became rotten. People, men who had been courageous fighters, courageous, dedicated patriots coming out of the war, lost it. I know them. I knew them personally. I saw them after the war. Naturally, you know, the war's over, you go look up your old buddies and you talk to them. You find out what they're doing. It wasn't good. They turned into cowards. Some of us fought against it. I did. I was convinced to. I tried to get Eisenhower to run for president in 1947. He sent me back a nice letter acknowledging my argument. Get this bum Truman out of there. Run for president. Because that we, who had gone to war, the best of us at least, had come back with some sense that we had a mission. We were the one nation, the power in this planet. We had a chance to bring about a just world order, as Roosevelt had promised. We could end colonialism. We could create a world with our influence of sovereign nation states, not an American empire, but a world of neighbors, of sovereign nation states. We could help them become strong with our economic power. We could cooperate with them. We could eliminate the possibility of putting the world through another kind of war, such as the two world wars we've just gone through in that century. We were optimistic. Suddenly, this went. We turned against each other. We lost our optimism. Then Truman got us deeper and deeper. The Korean War had started. Then in the course of that, someone discovered that the Soviet Union had developed the first deployable thermonuclear weapon on the planet. At that point, a nuclear-armed United States was not going to be capable of making a surprise nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. We entered, therefore, into a new order of things. Truman was told not to run again, and he didn't. They wouldn't even let a Democrat become president because of what Truman had done to the Democratic Party. It was not McCarthyism that was the problem. It was Trumanism. And now as then, the Democratic Party has some bad things in it. So we turned to a man who, like MacArthur, was opposed to these kinds of military policies, to a General Dwight Eisenhower, whose first act in campaigning for president, significant act, was to go to Korea and say, I can end our war in Korea. So we elected Eisenhower, and we felt better, even though Adlai Stevens was not disliked. We felt better because we thought we had avoided the worst. We had 8 years of relative peace under Eisenhower, though we had skunks in there, two Dulles skunks, Allen and John Foster, and some others, who were lurking there in the woodwork, ready to strike. Eisenhower left office at the beginning of 61 and made a speech warning the American people against what Truman had represented, the military-industrial complex. That wasn't the name I call it, but that was a fairly fair descriptive name. Jack Kennedy was president, but Jack was not prepared quite to deal with what he was getting into. He was taken by surprise at certain things he didn't understand clearly, until he understood a few things at the bedside of General Douglas MacArthur, who explained some things to him that caused Jack to realize he had to pull out of the Vietnam Indochina operation. Not have an Indochina war. MacArthur told him, don't go into a land war in Asia. No U.S. land war in Asia. Kennedy thought it was a good idea. He took this fellow you know here, McNamara, he took him to the White House and he gave him a tongue lashing. He probably still got scars in his back from the tongue lashing that Jack Kennedy gave him. If you can get him to come out and open, he'll probably admit that. And Jack humiliated McNamara. He made him stand on the White House steps and forswear everything that McNamara was committed to. He said we were going to pull out. Because these young people were so terrified of the reality with which they've been associated. Decided this society is no good. We got to drop out. Technology is bad. And so we had the baby boomer generation, the flight from reality. So we tried to transform from the greatest producers. Becoming a post-industrial society, in going from the great producer nation to becoming the predatory great consumer nation. This happened as a process which accelerated by 1971-72. In 1966, Nixon went down to Mississippi, to Biloxi, and there he met the Ku Klux Klan, and he saw God. This was the beginning of the Southern Strategy, which the Democratic Party in more later years began to try to imitate. They call it the Suburban Strategy. You may have heard about it. So we became rotten. And under the influence of Nixon's administration, or actually he was a captive of Henry Kissinger, but that's all right. Under that, in 1971-72, the post-war monetary system, which had been developed by President Roosevelt, was shut down. And we had a new kind of monetary system, the so-called floating exchange rate monetary system, which exists now. Now, what's happened is, over this period, from the period of the early 60s, the missile crisis, the assassination of Kennedy, and the entry into the Indochina War, there has been a transformation, a cultural transformation in our people. This cultural transformation has gone on, it's unfolded, it's developed, but we're now at the fag end of it. We've now reached the point where we live on the basis of virtually slave labor in China, on the basis of Mexican labor, of a Mexico which no longer has real economic sovereignty. We destroyed that in 1982 on, looting much of the world to produce for us what we no longer produce for ourselves. Our farms are ruined. Our farmers are ruined. Our industries are ruined. Our jobs have fled. What is made in Detroit is no longer made in Detroit. It's assembled from what's made in many parts of the world, and that increasingly so. Our productive powers are gone. Our infrastructure has collapsed. Our mass transit system has collapsed. Our air travel system is crazy and collapsing. Our power generation and distribution systems are disintegrating. We've come to the point that the debt of the United States under present conditions could never be paid. And that is the condition of much of the world beside. We are now at the end of the great cultural paradigm shift from being the great producer nation that Roosevelt's recovery enabled us to become, to becoming a ruined and rotten post-industrial society, a consumer society, living by driving down the values of currencies of other nations and forcing them to work for us as virtual slave labor while ruining themselves. But we, while ruining and sucking on the blood of these other nations, have also ruined ourselves at home. We've destroyed our own people. The HMO program is mass murder. It accelerates the death rate. And a willful acceleration of the death rate through the HMO system is nothing but systematic mass murder. Mass murder of our own citizens. Our education system is an abomination, as well as our healthcare system. Our general infrastructure is rotten. Our industries are fled. We are now at the end of a process under which the values which people have been conditioned to accept as normal values, the values which have guided them in voting, in what they decided, what they put up with, has changed the population to the point that what people think they ought to do today by instinct is wrong. And the candidates they think they should vote for are the wrong choice. Now take a look at some of the candidates. Take a look at Senator Kerry, Democratic candidate. I'll say nothing about the poor dummy that's now the president. He has no qualification whatsoever, except meanness, and that doesn't get you very much. All right, but look at Kerry. Now, Kerry's not a stupid guy. Personally, man to man, he's not an uncourageous person, intelligent person. Why is he behaving so stupidly? You have, Gephardt is not a great genius, but he's sort of a normal political man. Why is he behaving so stupidly? Well, of the rest, I won't say much. But why do we choose, why does the party itself, the National Democratic Party, produce nothing but stupid candidates or unqualified ones, even among people who themselves are personally qualified as human beings to make many kinds of important decisions in government? Why can't we find a president who is qualified for the office at this time? Why can't we find voters who are qualified to choose a suitable president for this time? Thank you. Get my phlegm under control. You're born in New England, you tend to get phlegm. It's a result of living by the coast there. You get these kinds of problems. But anyway, so that's the nature of our problem. It is not the fact, we're not merely in the process of trying to choose a president. We have to recognize there's something wrong with the voters themselves. Otherwise, we wouldn't have picked the idiot we picked recently. There's something wrong with the voters. Not merely a lack of courage. Admittedly, many people are afraid. They vote for certain candidates because they're afraid not to be caught voting for them. When you have a trade union and a political party machine which is ready to ruin you and destroy your life if you don't go along to get along, Sure, it's true. People are terrified into voting for these candidates, terrified in not voting for me. They're terrified of threats on the job. They're terrified by their union, of victimization there. There's a reign of terror by these institutions, including the Democratic Party and some of the unions of this country. A reign of terror against the people to try to intimidate them into voting for incompetent candidates and incompetent policies. But that's not the end of it. The problem lies in the people themselves. A people that is determined not to be slaves will not be slaves. What are we enslaved to then? What are so many of our citizens enslaved to? They're enslaved to their habits. The habit of post-industrial society. The habit of living in a consumer pleasure society. Look at Detroit. The jobs have gone. What comes in? The casinos. Is a casino a productive enterprise? It produces the money from your pockets into somebody else's. The croupier takes your money. We had the case of this boat on the Mississippi, a gambling boat, casino, a floating casino. It went to one city, got the money out of that population, and moved on to the next city. Moved down to St. Louis to try to loot the people of St. Louis next. Why do people gamble? Why do they gamble when they're poor? Don't they know they're going to lose? Otherwise, they wouldn't set up gambling casinos unless it was rigged to have the suckers lose. So why do people go in there like shark bait to be eaten? Why do they consider that an alternative to industry, to agriculture, to efficient power production and distribution? Why do they accept that? Because they've been conditioned that that's the way it is. This is what we've learned. In 40 years, we've learned how not to be like what we were 40 years ago. We've learned like the Romans. The Romans had conquered pretty much the world from Italy, beginning the end of the Second Punic War. They introduced mass slavery into Italy itself. They shut down production inside Italy because they began to steal from the rest of the world, the conquered world. They turned their population into a system of bread and circuses. Bread was passed out like welfare. There were no jobs, no real income. To keep the population quiet, you opened up the casinos, the Colosseum. Right? You got in there and you watched people kill each other for your entertainment. You watch animals eat people for your entertainment, as you do when you watch television or go to movies today. It's what you do when you go to these mass rock concerts and so forth. The same thing. Bread and circuses. Crumbs to get by on. Entertainment to take the pain. Drugs to take the pain away. We are destroying our population because we are accepting this change in values, which came on, as it did for ancient Italy, upon us today. That is the reason why I started tonight the way I did. Because when you look back and look at the experience of those of my generation who are here tonight, recall what our experience was. Recall the experience of our generation's children, the experience of our generation's grandchildren. And then look at our grandchildren and our children from my generation and see what happened to them, what happened to their minds, how they were changed to become people who would willingly submit to a process by which they are destroying themselves. Because you have the power. People have the power intrinsically, if they're willing to exert it, to change things. A generation older than mine, my parents' generation, voted for Roosevelt, supported Roosevelt, and took us out of a time when we were culturally rotten back in the 1920s, and brought us back to becoming ourselves so we emerged from the war as a great producer nation, a power in the world for good, if Roosevelt had lived. We were still a producer nation up to the middle of the 1960s. We helped Europe develop. We contributed to the development of many other parts of the world. We were useful despite the fact that we were being bad at the same time. But then, with the missile crisis, the Kennedy assassination, and the beginning of the Indochina War, and the beginning of the great cultural paradigm shift, which started on the stage of Ed Sullivan's CBS show with the Beatles. With that, we became something else. We didn't become rotten all at once. We became rotten step by step by step by step. Every time you accept doing a rotten thing, you become a bit rotten yourself, if that becomes a habit. And that's what happened to us. Now, therefore, what will change us? What will save us? We have to change our way of thinking. And the first thing to do is to recognize what the changes were in these three successive generations which have brought us to the point that we are inflicting upon ourselves our own destruction as a nation. That's the problem. It's my job, not merely as a candidate, to do that for you, to try to induce you to look into yourselves, to look into the experience of my generation, look into the experience of my children's generation, my grandchildren's generation. See what they've gone through, how the cowardice of the returning veteran in suburbia taught their children never to tell the truth. It might get you into trouble. Say what is expected of you. Never say what you think. Say what you want to be overheard saying. This is the typical baby boomer mentality. When the baby boomer mentality was hit by the combination of the missile crisis, the Kennedy assassination, and Laurel, whores be me. We have to go over as us nice little kids, we have to go to Vietnam and fight that war. No, we don't do that. That's not nice. So with these kinds of terrors, we'll flee into drugs instead of going to Vietnam. We'll destroy ourselves with drugs. So it was this process that we corrupted ourselves as a people. But people who are capable of making scientific discoveries intrinsically, people can see what's wrong with their own minds. They can see how their minds were ruined over successive generations by the change of an opinion. People can change themselves. Animals cannot change themselves. People can change themselves. And they can change themselves because they have a higher power to reflect upon themselves, to decide what they wish to become. People of my generation also have another advantage. We're going to die soon. And therefore, our values are improved thereby. Because we don't think of what we're going to get. We think of what we're going to give. What we're going to give to coming generations. The meaning of our life, our sense of immortality, is what we give. That is, if we're smart. We're not stupid. We don't expect to take anything. We expect to give. And that's our strength. If we look at ourselves as people who are going to give rather than take, then we use our lives to say, I can die with a smile on my face because I have given something. My life means something because I gave something to humanity. I gave honor to the achievements and contributions of the generations that came before me. And I give a future to my grandchildren and those of my grandchildren's generation. That gives you strength because you have a sense of spirituality, a sense that man is not a piece of flesh, that man is a mind which exists only in the human being. And that mind has a quality of immortality. And therefore, the meaning of your life is what you do with what you are while you're here. Something that will last. Something that will make your ancestors smile and make your descendants happy and proud of you. When you look at yourself and say, that is my interest. That is what I wish to become. That kind of person. To achieve that kind of immortality, legitimate immortality that I have earned, then you have the power to change yourself. and change the way you think in a scientific way by looking at experience, as I tried to summarize that kind of experience to you tonight, to look at the experience of successive generations, to see how ideas and passions were transmitted from one generation to another, and how the young generation coming into the field now, the one I'm so happy about, the youth generation, the 18 to 25-year-old university-eligible age youth, why they're so important to me and to you. Because if we can enable them to help convince their parents to come back to the human race, leave baby boomerism, and come back and start thinking about the future of humanity, and if those two generations, the generation of my children and my grandchildren's generation, if those two generations start working together to change society, to meet the challenge of the present, we have in our nation a great tradition, if we can recognize it. We have the power, the influence, if we do that, to influence the course of world history, not as an empire, not as a dictator. Well, I have friends in India. I have friends in Russia. I have friends throughout Europe. I have friends in South America. I have friends in Africa. These are my friends. We have the power in the United States. If I can act as a friend of these friends, we can bring the nations together with the example of the struggle to establish our republic and to bring forth in us the best that we have been. We have the ability to bring these nations together and say, here we are. We're in this period, we're all afraid of the spread of a nuclear armed war being organized by people like Cheney and the so-called neoconservatives and some of the Democrats like Lieberman and so forth who are going along with it. We can avoid this. We can avoid plunging this planet into war. We have a great economic crisis. We can lead in creating a recovery from this world economic crisis, as Roosevelt led in bringing us out of the last great crisis. We can do that. We can take my friends abroad. We can bring them together. And we can say, we're all going to be sovereign republics, no empire, nothing like empire. We're going to create what John Quincy Adams and other great leaders of the United States intended. Community on this nation, on this planet, a community of perfectly sovereign republics, which are united by principles akin to those enshrined in the preamble of our federal constitution. We can actually create an order of peace on this planet, of durable peace, which can survive. We can do that now. I can do that now if I'm president. I could do it today if I were president. All the resources are there. We could recover from this depression. All the potential is there. We simply have to decide that we're not going to continue to play the game which is wrought upon us when we submitted one after the other to these things that betrayed what Franklin Roosevelt had tried to give us in his lifetime. Not as results, but as the ability to make the decision to achieve those results. We can do it. And now there are other matters you want to discuss, and I'll discuss them with you as you ask about it.
Thank you.
Hello, young man.
Good.
Very good.
Maybe I'll ask a question. Are you going to
do that thing next?
Sure.
Whatever they want. You know.
There we go.
I'm their man.
Bear with us for a minute.
I strongly encourage everyone to take a bundle or two or three or four of the pamphlets and the leaflets and distribute them widely. Mr. LaRouche's campaign website is listed there. You'll be able to follow all of the activities of the campaign, both those that will be forthcoming and all of the activities of the campaign going back to January of 2001. Are we back on now? So you'll have access to everything that the campaign is going to be doing and already has done. Now, we started a tradition in these campaign webcasts a short while ago to demonstrate to you the leadership of the LaRouche Youth Movement that has been developing over the course of the last 4 years. And turning over the moderation of the question and answer session of these meetings to a representative of the youth movement. Robert Lucero, what happened to him? Okay, well, as soon as he gets back, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Robert, who is one of the leaders of the LaRouche Youth Movement here in Detroit. Are we back on again? Or are we still working on it? The microphone's working here. Are we hooked up? For those of you listening on the World Wide Web, you are listening to a live broadcast from the Pontchartrain Hotel in Detroit, Michigan. You're listening to a meeting of the Lyndon LaRouche presidential campaign. Mr. LaRouche is campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination. If you miss Mr. LaRouche's address, I strongly urge you to log back into the website a little bit later tonight. The audio of his presentation will be available on the website. Is Robert here yet? Then, Bob, why don't you step up to the microphone and start taking names for questions. You have to? You want to bring them right up, and I'll call on them right away. Okay, the first question is from Lou Loudon. I'll ask everyone who comes to the microphone to please identify yourself, where you're from, if you're representing any institution, please. Lou.
My name is Louis R. Loudon. I happen to be PR chair for the Gratiot County Democratic Party, though I am not speaking for him here, but only for myself. And I want to thank Bob Bowen and Lyndon LaRouche for coming to Michigan and being here. Of course, Bob, you're with us all the time. We have to live with that. Mr. LaRouche, would you be kind enough to repeat what you told me earlier when I commented to you about being and speaking with Mark Brewer on the 15th? We were at a caucus session, and at that session, he clearly informed us that Mr. LaRouche is not a Democrat and that only those candidates that would be on the caucus voting list would actually be counted, that anyone else who was written in would be lumped in with Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck.
Let's take a couple of facts about this just to get the idea of how ridiculous this is. Currently, among 9 nominal or 10 nominal candidates for the Democratic nomination, that is officially registered candidates with the FEC, I represent second in popularity, that is, in the number of people who have made financial contributions to my campaign. Second. Now, the first, of course, is Dean. And Dean has facilities I don't have, but that's all right. The others have bucks, but they don't have support. The others have bucks, but they don't campaign. They campaign. And these things we call campaign debates. And everyone I've seen so far is disgusting. The one in Detroit, sponsored by Fox TV, which is hardly a good symbol for the Democratic Party, As a matter of fact, I understand in most areas, Fox is considered a racist right-wing organization. And I don't know why the Democratic Party would want to be the hosted by a fascist or fascistic right-wing racist organization like Murdoch's Fox TV. But actually the performance of the candidates on that particular event were about as bad as Fox TV itself. It was disgusting. All of the campaign appearances in these debates have been disgusting. There's no independent voice. That doesn't mean that Kerry's incapable of carrying an idea across the room. He is. That doesn't mean that Kucinich is stupid. I think he's a little weak in some respects, but he's an intelligent person and is actually intelligent on many issues and does a fairly decent function in the Congress. I don't think anything of John of Howard Dean. He's a guy who never practiced medicine, but he does practice HMO, which kills more people than doctors could save. So this is the reality. Now, what we have is we have a president of the United States, George W. Bush, who is losing the next election. He's losing. He's losing it on the issue of the war, which is becoming increasingly unpopular. He's losing it on the issues of the economy. But he might be elected. Why? Because the Democratic Party is much better at losing than the Republicans are. They work at it, as they did in California. Look, just give an example of this, because this question probably is in the mind of a lot of people, apart from being asked appropriately by one of our people here. In California, you had a fascist. I don't know whether he has a Nazi Party card-carrying member or not. His father was. But he thinks like a Nazi. He acts like a Nazi. He smells like a Nazi. Schwarzenegger, whose qualification for governor are those he displays in the movie as the Terminator. Now, and California is a predominantly Democratic state. Registered Democrats outnumber any other species in California. Now, they may come in different colors and varieties, but they're all the same Democratic Party species. How could they lose a recall election to an unqualified, menacing thug? And as a matter of fact, the thug who happened to be among those who helped loot the state of California through Enron-style operations. Now, how could Democratic Party lose that? Well, Gray Davis is not a bad guy, but the Democratic National Committee came down on Gray Davis, and each of the other presidential candidates who came in, including also Clinton, Bill Clinton, came in to tell Gray Davis to cool it. Now, Gray Davis is an experienced politician and a well-known street fighter when it comes to politics. He didn't street fight. He could have taken on and beaten Schwarzenegger, but he took a fall, as if the mafia had told him it's time to take the fall. Not all of his people took the fall. All right, we were the youth movement in California. We had forces which were adequate to deploy into Los Angeles County. We had the cooperation of the leadership in Los Angeles County for our operation. We also deployed in the Bay Area. At the time the campaign started, the polls were showing Schwarzenegger running 60-40 against Gray Davis. By the time we ended up in Los Angeles County, we carried it 51-49 against Schwarzenegger. In the Bay Area, we did better. In the other parts of California, the state was lost, because the Democratic National Committee and all of the presidential candidates except me, who intervened in that thing, had gone the other way and enforced Gray Davis to throw the election. We then went with our youth movement into Philadelphia, invited by Mayor Street. And the mayor was there when this transaction was conducted. And Harold James set it up and said, well, are you on board? I said, of course I'm on board. That's a done deal. We're doing it. So we did it. And we turned a marginal situation in Philadelphia into a landslide victory. Because the participation of the various forces which were associated with us, that Harold James brought together, that we brought in, transformed the Democratic election campaign from an election campaign into a movement. We had a movement of citizens in that city, and they carried the election even against a very well-oiled Republican machine, which came in prepared to win. Now, under these circumstances, since we win and they lose, why does the Democratic Party convince to do what it did in 2000? To elect two bums, Gore and Lieberman. And now by now you should see what a bum he is. You may not have known it beforehand, but now it's easy. This is a guy, a right-winger, who was brought into politics or into high politics by William F. Buckley, a great Democrat and fascist, with a generation of fascists. The whole family is a bunch of fascists. And also brought into power by money from the so-called Gusanos, the Batista Cubans in southern Florida. That's his constituency. He was picked for vice presidential candidate. He robs Indians. Since he doesn't have many Indians in the state of Connecticut, they invented Indians, and they robbed them. Gambling casinos. And Gore, who couldn't lose on paper, with Clinton backing Gore, he couldn't lose. But he did. And he actually lost Florida. Sure, there was a certain African-American vote turned out in Florida, but they didn't get counted. Because the Republicans had done their homework and made sure that their absentee ballots were processed, whereas the Democrats didn't do it. And therefore, their absentee ballots weren't processed. And thus, a lot of Arab Americans voted for George Bush in Florida. They regret it today. Right? So what he did, he could have won in Tennessee. If he'd won Arkansas, which would have been an easy win, Gore would be president of the United States today. But the bum wouldn't do what he should do. He wouldn't even cooperate with Clinton at certain points. He went into this dive in Florida, which is a sure loser, an unnecessary battle. He wasted his effort and money in Florida, gave up Arkansas and Tennessee, and lost the national election with a plurality of national votes. And the Democratic Party has apparently learned, and Clinton himself, have apparently learned nothing from that experience. So the question is not who's going to win the next election, which party is going to lose it, the biggest. Right? So the point now, that's the situation. What is obvious is what I referred to earlier. We're in what I've referred to as a reverse cultural paradigm shift. The things that I'm proposing, the course of action which I'm proposing, take politics back to the street. Take politics back to the street, to the real people. Take it to the lower 80% of family income brackets. Don't depend upon the upper 20% of family income brackets. Get the people back into the politics. The lower 80% of family income brackets, the poor, the young, get them back in. And do it not as vetting one vote at a time, create a movement. Now, I've designed the catalyst for a movement. And the catalyst for a movement is a youth movement, which we've pioneered in creating, of a special type of young people, largely between 18 and 25 years of age, that is a university-eligible age, and we're running a university on wheels among people who are living on virtually nothing, next to nothing. They get their meals, and they got to find a place to sleep and do things like that. And they're out organizing in teams, and they can out-organize per capita anybody else in the United States. They're the most effective organizing, political organizing force in this country. Now they number in the hundreds. We're going to have 1,000 of them deployed by probably about February. We expect by the summer, before the summer runs around, 10,000 of this type. With 10,000 such youth, we can turn the country around. We can change it. We can win any election that is not done by a police state method. So therefore, here we are. These guys are losers. They're losers by every standard. The party itself, the party machine, the national chairmanship, is a loser by any standard. Now, how can anyone say they're serious about politics of excluding the real potential winner in favor of a bunch of losers? And why should they try to bore the citizens to death to have these nine clowns go on TV for racist Fox TV as a sponsor, rather than having a serious discussion of the real issues of the economy and war and such similar things before the public? The American people want to hear about the war. That's why Bush is going down. The Iraq war, that's the trigger. Get this thing out, quit. Get out of there. People are dying. They're sending people who are normally family people, as National Guardsmen and Reservists, they're sending them into battle for prolonged duty. That has a tremendous impact upon communities because these are family people with established families. To lose a member of the family, to have a member of the family go through trauma and come back severely injured, the life support of the family, and then to deny these people the kind of medical care they require as a result of these war injuries and turn them back in the communities, that's not going to be popular. And we have a ratio about, out of 8 trauma cases, 7 now survive. So it's a high rate of survival relative to battle trauma relative to previous kinds of wars, which means we have a lot of injured people who are not being treated properly in most cases coming back, and the families are screaming about it. The economic question, look around you. Look at the conditions of life of the lower 80%. Look at 47 states in the United States are bankrupt. That is, you could not raise enough money through tax revenue to balance the essential costs of running that state. At least 47 states, if not all 50. And it's getting worse. We have $1 trillion for a trade balance deficit. We're shooting toward $1 trillion annual deficit. The thing is falling apart. The world is collapsing. We can have at any time a housing crisis. I'll just give you an example. This is maybe long-winded, but I think it's probably valuable to you. Look, what happened? Look around you in this city. Has Detroit been depopulated within the past 15 years? All right. Has Michigan largely been depopulated during this period? Why? Because the jobs have gone. This is all around the country. Now, what happened? The people who moved away, in large degree, not all of them, would move in as younger people into jobs in areas around in California, around Washington, D.C., other areas where you have a housing boom. Now, this housing boom is rather disgusting because they take a piece of a cow pasture. They put a plow through it once or twice, a bulldozer. They put a foundation on it, this area. They take a piece of a tar paper shack, virtually. They shrink wrap it with insulation. They paste some plastic on the exterior to make it look like brick or something else. They put a couple of faucets in it. They call it a house. Now, people who want a job in this area go into this area to take the job because the job isn't here in Michigan. It's not in Detroit. They'll go down, say, to someplace outside Washington. They'll move into this shack, and they find the mortgage is $400,000 to $600,000 for a tar paper shack with shrink wrap features. And it's not even good for you because if it's sealed, certain kinds of gases will get into the house, and they're not good for your health on top of everything else. Now, what happens is these people are now losing money because there is terrible inflation. Maybe some of you know something about this terrible inflation. You may have experienced it someplace. So therefore, people have a trouble getting by. Even people, we have two people with fairly skilled jobs, working two jobs in a household. They're not bringing enough home to pay the rent and the mortgage. Remember, in the old days, you would consider you spend 20% or 25% at most of your family income for housing. Right? Now, what kind of salary do you require by that standard to maintain a house which has a $400,000 to $600,000 mortgage value? What kind of a salary? You're talking about $100,000 income a year. How many of you got $100,000 a year? How many people do you know who have it? So therefore, we have people who are on the margin of poverty living in these tar paper shacks at a $500,000 or so, plus or minus, mortgage valuation. How do they get by? A swindle was pulled by a swindler called Alan Greenspan. He's the head of the Federal Reserve Bureau agency. What he did is he pumped money to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. He did it in concert with real estate swindlers who sell real estate. The real estate swindlers in this area, say the area around Northern Virginia, would meet. And they would tell the bankers that the value of real estate in this area has gone up. Therefore, these houses all are now worth more. Now, the banks are willing to give a 90% credit on the value of the mortgage to the house owner, or the nominal house owner. So they go down to the bank, and they get cash by refinancing the mortgage based on the increase, the purely synthetic increase in the value of the house. What do they do with the cash? They spend it for groceries and foolish things like that to get by. What happens then if a 1% or 2% increase in interest rates occurs? Boom. Real estate bubble goes, housing shacks go down to half the value, and so forth. And that's the condition we've created as a result of this change in the U.S. economy. Instead of taking the area of Michigan, which is naturally an area for certain kinds of production, and northern Ohio, and Ohio in general, you take this area, which used to be an area which was designated geographically as a place for agriculture and industry, which has a natural potential because of the Great Lakes, among other things, for this, because of the transportation systems that used to exist here. You move the people out of the area, of land area, which is perfectly habitable, economically functional land area. You chase a part of the population into absolute poverty. You chase the other part to seek jobs in these areas of these housing boom speculations. And then you bring down the shadow, you bring down the whole shadow. This is the kind of situation we're in today. And therefore, the economic issue, the health care issue, and other things, yet all other things that are crashing down on the people. So therefore, suppose we, all of us discuss, in a presidential candidacy, discuss before the American people, discuss the issue of the war. How do we get into this stinking mess? How did Cheney get us into it? How are we going to get out? Are we going to go into more wars? Can't we avoid more wars? Why have we got more enemies in the world than we ever had before? Practically the entire world is against the United States today. Because of what happened since January 2002. Isn't that worth discussing? Isn't that the issue? What about the economy? What about the condition of our people? What about the things that are threatening about people, including the health issue? Why aren't those being discussed, apart from some master plan? Why don't we say what was wrong and say how we're going to fix it? But first admit that it was wrong. And it's not done. So somebody says, I shouldn't be a candidate. What are they doing, committing suicide?
Mr. Lucero has rejoined us. So I'm going to turn the podium and the question and answer session over to Mr. Robert Lucero from the LaRouche Youth Movement here in Detroit.
Oh, we have a list already?
Yes.
Okay. By the way, I don't know. I'm sorry I missed the quick exchange there, but I would certainly encourage the younger members of the audience to ask a question if they've had a question, either from reading literature, coming to the office, or from what Mr. LaRouche had to say. And I can just tell you and tell Mr. LaRouche that we've been having a lot of fun coming into this meeting, shaking up the entire area at University of Michigan, Wayne State, the local colleges. We almost, without intending to, shut down Macomb Community College the other day just by being there in the middle of the school with your ideas. So it's a lot of fun, and I encourage everybody to not only join us in this fight, but to naturally tell everybody else you know about what we're doing. If I forget, Nick Fedden from the Philadelphia branch of the East Coast LaRouche Youth Movement suggested that for the younger members of the audience, we have a youth meeting after the proceedings here, right outside in the lobby, to discuss where we go from here. So the next question is from Joe Barrera.
All right. I'm from Oakland County, LaRouche Democrat up there. I guess I'm caught in this paradox here. I said, should I renew my membership in the Democratic Party? And also, with the fight that we had in the 2000 election with the Secretary of State and the Democratic Party, are we going to be facing this thuggish behavior from the Dems and the state of Michigan?
Of course you do. Of course you establish your membership in the Democratic Party. It's your party. It belongs to you. Now, there may be some slight misunderstanding among some people as to presently what that means. But it's your party. And what we have to do is convince those people who need to be convinced, to be convinced. And what we're doing, we would shame them, we would humiliate them, we would encourage them, we would tell them the redemption is always only a few steps away. And that's...
The next person in line is Haza Shahit.
Good evening. In October, economist Paul Krugman wrote an article in the New York Times where he described an impending economic crisis in the U.S. And he likened the situation of the American public to that of Wile E. Coyote in the Roadrunner cartoon, where the Wile E. Coyote would run off the edge of a cliff, and he'd run a short distance before he realized he was walking on thin air, and only after he looked down and realized where he was at, then he would fall. And he said, and he described the situation of the situation of the American public as at the point where it's walking on thin air, and economically speaking, and it only has to realize what the economic the lack of economic foundation for its economy, and then it will start to fall, by meaning that there will either be a sell-off, or, in any case, he described it as the ensuing chaos, which would be the situation. Do you see an Argentina-type economic crisis here in the U.S. as inconceivable as that may be to someone of my generation?
It's not inconceivable. What you have to understand is this about this question about myth and reality. That what people believe, human beings are voluntary. Animals are committed to certain types of behavior as a species or a variety of a species. It's almost biological commitment. They have a very slight range of adjustment. Whereas human beings can choose the, let me set one back. Now think of this human mind or the mind of an animal. It's like a typical utopian geometry in which you start with certain definitions, axioms, and postulates. And you assume that any valid theorem that you reach any decision you make must prove itself to be consistent with those definitions, axioms, and postulates. In an animal, the range of definitions and axioms is very narrow. The animal is capable of certain postulational changes. For example, when you make a pet of an animal successfully from childhood of the animal, you may induce this animal to behave not like an animal, but by an animal who now is adapted to human beings. When you adopt a puppy or adopt a kitten, for example, the thing will now respond to you. It has not become human, but it will see almost human because it knows how to react to you as a puppy or a cat. It knows how to react to you according to its axioms, and it has certain postulates which you induce. And it becomes very attached to you. It actually may, sometimes it'll think it runs you, but most of the time it'll think that you are its mother or father or whatever. Or a dog, you are the boss of the poodle, of the pack. But with human beings, it's different. We have the ability to choose our definitions, axioms, and postulates. Now, we can choose two types. We can choose definitions that are accurate or false. We can choose axioms and postulates similarly, true or false. Or we can omit some essential knowledge of some essential axioms, and so forth. So what happens is that in mass behavior, people will tell you, and you can recognize this in various ways, this is what I believe. This is what I have to do. Sometimes they aren't conscious of what these things are, but you can detect that by observing them. What happens in a cultural paradigm shift is that the set of definitions, axioms, and postulates, as a set, of a population is conditioned in a way which is either relatively true or relatively false. For example, the existence of the United States as a constitutional republic had a great effect on the American people. And to this day, we benefit from that tradition, though most of us are not fully conscious of how that works. In Europe, they're different. In Europe, they've been living under, at least on the relatively less unfree countries in Europe, they've been living under what's called a Anglo-Dutch parliamentary liberal system, in which the independent central banking systems have the ultimate power, and every time there's a crisis, the parliament's overthrown and a new government is put in. In our system, we have never had a change in our constitutional form of government since our birth. There's no other nation on this planet which has achieved that success. So therefore, we have a relatively superior constitutional system when we use it properly. All right. Now, what happens then is that we then, as has happened to us over the past period, by conditioning, we have to accept nuclear weapons. We have to accept the Cold War. We have to accept McCarthyism. We have to accept this. We have to accept the lessons of the missile crisis. We have to accept the assassination of Kennedy without a due investigation. We have to accept the Vietnam War. It would be unpatriotic not to. And so forth and so on. We have to accept the free trade system. We have to accept deregulation. So we have a lot of these things we have come to accept as if they were axioms of our economic system and our political system. You have to accept the leadership of the Democratic Party. Well, I don't accept that axiom. Therefore, I'm not a slave to that axiom. I'm not going to be a dummy on somebody's string like a puppet. I cut that string and express my freedom. So the problem, therefore, is in economics. What has killed us is, if you look at the three curves I often use as pedagogical, what has happened since 1966, when the change occurred under the conditions of the Vietnam War, certain changes in economic policy began to be introduced as a product of financing the Vietnam War in the 1966-67 period. We began to shut down the space program, for example. We began to shut down high tech. We began to cut down infrastructure development, all to finance this so-called balance the budget for this Vietnam War, the Indochina War. Right, so at that point, since that point, so about 66, the amount of financial aggregate, that is the amount of monetary aggregate and financial aggregate per capita and per square kilometer of the United States has zoomed at an accelerating rate. The rate of inflation in the United States is horrendous. Somebody tells you there's no inflation, they're lying. They use the quality adjustment index, the so-called hedonic index. It's fake. We have the highest rate of inflation in our history right now. There is no zero inflation. We have negative growth, which is concealed by pretending that there is no inflation. So you use numbers, use fake numbers, inflated numbers, and deny that we're shrinking. We're shrinking. All right, what people say is, no, you have to go by monetary policy. You have to go by free trade. You have to assume the price is right. In the same period, we've had, in order to maintain this financial growth, we've been printing money. We make the Japanese print money overnight to finance the U.S. markets. The stock market is a bubble. There's no value in the stock market. It's a bubble. There's no solid physical value there. It's less and less all the time. But we assume, according to the axiom, the puppet strings. No, you have to respect that. Monetary authorities tell us. John Snow, the idiot, tells us, the Treasury Secretary, that perennial liar who will never come clean, no matter how long he sits in his bathtub, Alan Greenspan, never tell us the truth. But in the meantime, if you look at the physical values per capita, per square kilometer in the country, look at income, look at pensions, look at power generation and distribution, look at health care, look at education, look at the physical standard of living, and look whether or not we're using up infrastructure we invested in a long time ago. Highways, bridges, power stations, educational systems, all kinds of things. Are we using things up? Yes, we have been precipitously declining. So we have monetary values are up, financial values are up, physical values are down, except for a few people who are bloodsuckers who seem to enjoy a richer standard of living. So therefore, the problem is that when people talk about the Wile E. Coyote, Wile E. Coyote is the financial aggregate. He's soaring wildly. He thinks he's crossing the chasm with nothing underneath. And then one day the world looks down underneath Wile E. Coyote and say there's nothing underneath there. The jobs have gone. The production is gone. We're no longer a production nation. What happens when the world no longer gives the United States credit? The U.S. dollar could drop to about 30%. It's already dropped about 10-15% in the recent period under Bush. It's already dropped. It's going to drop a lot more. The drop is already occurring. But Wile E. Coyote says it's not occurring. The U.S. economy is sound. Our policies are sound. We're not going to change our policy. We're going back to more deregulation. They didn't do enough deregulation. We already destroyed California. We're not satisfied. There's still something left in California. We're going to put Schwarzenegger in and really destroy it. So that's what the problem is. It's not just a question of perception. There's a reality here. The reality is one day the motor doesn't start. And that's the time you know that Wile E. Coyote is going to go down. Now, Krugman is not entirely unintelligent. He's pro-Democratic Party, and he has some Wall Street interests which are not exactly stupid. But I think the analogy is tricky in the sense that this is not something that's purely psychological. Economics is not psychological. It has a reality to it, a physical reality. Can you eat? That's a physical reality.
By the way, we've been taking this reality of what economics really is, these professors, and teaching them how to actually think about economics. Next question is from David Vernocchi. Is that close enough?
My question is, should schools teach memory improvement techniques? I think there isn't a subject that could help more different people in different ways. And if it was started in elementary school and just sort of incorporated with every class they take.
People think of memory as like a computer memory. Human memory doesn't work that way. Actually, if you think about it, you often find you can regenerate memory. You may call it recalling something, but it's actually not recalling. It's you're regenerating. Now, the way to develop the mind is to practice regeneration. How do you do that? You do that preferably from an early age, not by teaching people multiple choice questionnaire passing. That's the worst thing you can do for a human mind. Never give a subjective child to a multiple choice questionnaire. It's the cruelest, stupidest thing you can do to a child's mind. You develop the thing you want to develop in a child, and or in any person of any age, but it starts in childhood, obviously. The quality of being able to remember efficiently starts in childhood. How does it do it? Well, do you do as you're told, or do you have parents and teachers and friends who put you through the process of experiencing the act of discovery of truth? First of all, now you have to believe in truth, don't you? And I don't think there are many people in society today here who believe in truth. It's only a matter of opinion, you know. So all I have to do is remember your opinion. I don't have to know what the truth is. But truth is typified by the discovery of gravitation, as by Kepler, for example. It's a universal truth which cannot be seen, smelled, or etc. with the senses. You can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't taste it, but it's there. Is gravitation. It's an effect you cannot deny. Every time you see Mars appearing to loop in its orbit annually, you realize that there is a principle out there which is not what your senses tell you is there. There's a principle called gravitation. There are other principles, which include general physical principles, universal physical principles. We discover them. You cannot detect any of these principles directly with the senses. And yet they're an efficient object. And yet by man's controlling these principles and using them, we're able to increase the human species' potential to live. For example, if we were baboons, which many of our Democratic Party leaders are striving to become, then the human race would never have exceeded, in the past 2 million years, under conditions of the past 2 million years, would never have exceeded several million individuals at any one time. We have now reported on this planet over 6 billion human beings. How did that happen? No monkey could do it. And we have a couple of monkeys running for president, don't we? But they couldn't do it. How did it happen? Mankind made discoveries of principles. When man discovers a principle which existed in the universe before man existed, when we discover a principle, and we apply it efficiently by our will, we change the universe. We haven't added any new principles as such to the universe by doing so. But we have changed the universe because we have created another means by which the universe changes itself. And that is by the intervention of the human will. So therefore, we develop the land. We develop the conditions of life. We develop the technologies by which we prolong life, by which we increase the productive powers of labor. And that's the basis on which we know. Things we have discovered in that way we know. We also know that what we discover with our senses, we don't necessarily know. Most of the things we think we saw, eyewitness reports are the most unreliable source, apart from outright lying, the most reliable source of disinformation available. I know what I can taste and see and so forth. That's not truth. That's an impression. How do you know whether what you've seen is true? Well, you have to be able to demonstrate it. How? You have to show that your knowledge of some principle applied to the universe will actually make an improvement which otherwise could not exist. Then you know it's true. If it doesn't work, you've misunderstood. Either the principle is not true or you've misunderstood how to use it. So therefore, it's this kind of development, of developing in the child the ability to discover universal principles. And a child starts with many kinds of discoveries they have to make from infancy. They're discovering all the time. Babies are discovering at a very rapid rate under normal conditions. You may not see it, you see the effect. of how a child from one day to the other may change in character, how in a few weeks a child may change in its whole development and character. Those of you who have been parents know this. How in the early years a child changes rapidly. And very slight changes in conditions will accelerate that ability of the child to change. Favorable conditions will encourage the child to make breakthroughs, and you recognize them as breakthroughs. Right. Now, therefore, memory should be the ability to rediscover what you do not have in mind. Not a memory of an experience. Yes, that too. But be able to rediscover something you had forgotten when you need to remember. So memory has a characteristic of not being digital, but more holographic. Look, your brain cells are dying all the time. And when you begin to get, you know, bad condition, your brain cells degenerate more rapidly than you replace them. So you are constantly regenerating and replacing brain cells. So where is the memory stored? The memory exists in the form of a kind of holographic design, which is a process. And as you develop that ability, as you concentrate on discovering principles rather than trying to memorize experience, your ability to retain your powers of memory increase. So if you want to teach memory in school, you have to start that way. And people, when they get older, can actually fight against the tendency to lose memory by the same method. So what we should teach people is that. Because when people start to lose memory, it becomes a problem for them. So why don't we teach it? And why don't we teach it in young children too? But the key thing here is always start from a human being. And always start, as I do, from the difference between a human being and an animal. I like pets. I like animals. But I know they're animals. I know the animals like me, often. They participate in me. They make demands upon me. They feel that they have a right to control me. The dog will scratch at the door, or the puppy will whine, or the cat will meow, or will do something else to let you know they want you to do something. But we're human beings. We're not animals. And that's the way the thing works.
So Stephen Jeffries next, and then he's followed by Robert Detloff.
Hello. My question is very related to that same question. A little bit of a twist. It's more related to brainwashing. Why is it so prevalent in our? Why is it? Because it's very important for our generation to develop the means to combat this, you know? And you've brought up this idea of thought objects and how we can have ideas in mind with clarity that you can recall and you can use as something to... this idea, how do you create an idea in your mind that you can refer to, that makes sense, that is continually developing and...
That's why I did what I did with the youth movement. We started it about 4 years ago with a limited number of people in California. And the question is, you have to build a nucleus which is self-regenerating. So we did develop a self-regenerating nucleus of youth. And they spread their influence without my intervention themselves. The key thing here was to tap what I think is important, this difference between man and the animal. Here you come into a generation, you're part of the youth generation in particular. And people who are older should think about this, think about it very seriously. See, the baby boomer generation, in general, rejects their own children. And the children know it. Now the children have become young adults. They live in a terrible society which the baby boomer generation has largely created for them. A society of drugs. Now, people will be shocked about drug problems. But they often shock as baby boomers. They're not shocked as young people today. Because young people today are living in a culture which is shaped by poverty and by a drug culture. The characteristic feature of the drug culture is the teacher in school who forces a child to take Ritalin, or worst, Prozac. Several years of Prozac will destroy a personality, biologically. I've seen it. So we're living in a drug culture. People say, you've got a problem, take a psychotropic drug of some kind. Manage yourself with drugs. The children who've grown up now are imprisoned in a mass drug culture, which is probably rotating around some rave dance, some gigantic rave dance. These young people, if they're not themselves victimized by drug usage, have friends who are at the verge of destruction and often suicide as a result of a drug culture. This is aggravated by the fact that this is a no-future society now. And therefore, suicide tends to be an out from a society which is painful and which gives you no purpose for living as a human being. So therefore, given this case, we have the young people are looking at parents who have accepted this way of doing things. The post-industrial pleasure society, the consumer society, as opposed to productive society. They're not offended when factories close down. They say, I can get it cheaper from China. I don't care if the factory closes down. They go to Walmarts, and they say, I buy at Walmart because it's cheaper. Well, don't you know that Walmarts depends on largely slave labor from poor people who have moved into this, and just like cattle? Don't you know that the Walmart cheap prices are based on American companies closing up and shutting down their employment to buy their goods from other countries where cheap labor produces them, as in China, not the United States? Do you know that when Walmart moves into a county, there's a disaster for much of the county in terms of business and employment? This is the kind of society, the kind of culture. And when you have a generation which says, no, it's better because I get more from my money, and you get young people who are faced with a society which is generating in this way, with this kind of special kind of drug culture envelope which is grips it, with the stink of suicide increasing among people, juvenile suicide or adolescent suicide trends spilling over into people in their 20s as a result of this situation. And the older generation doesn't seem to care. It says, learn to get along. Learn to go along to get along. Right? So these young people say they don't trust the older generation. Some of them trust me. Why? Because I understand the problem. And because I propose an answer. The answer is their own self-education. And the education has to be based on a principle of truth. So therefore, I introduce this Gauss 7099 paper as an exemplary paper, because it shows not only a truth about mathematical thinking and about how the mind works, but also gives us a connection to ancient classical Greeks, the Pythagorean period. So it's valuable. So you have a sense of the... here are young people who see there's a gap, a break in the culture from one generation to the next. The baby boomer generation is like something that came in between my generation and the younger generation. And the younger people feel they're cut off from history, cut off from a meaningful connection to the past, looking for a reality in the present. And therefore, they have to have not only a sense of what truth is, but they have to have located historically. They have to have a sense of history, the kind of thing I tried to summarize today, in my remarks today. You must give young people a true sense of history, not history learned from a textbook, but history relived, re-experienced. You must relive the experience of generations before you. You must understand and feel what those experiences was. Then you have to locate yourself in respect to that, those past generations, and locate yourself in respect to the future in that way. So the only way this could work is by young people working it out among themselves, because their parents' generation does not have the ability to understand this problem emotionally. And what proves it is the way they vote. If the baby boomer generation had any sense, they wouldn't vote the way they vote. And the only reason they're going to change in the way I'm trying to change is because the conditions of life, on the one hand, show them that their way of life doesn't work. They have to change the way they think, the way they behave, because they're given an alternative. And the alternative comes to them in the form of seeing young people around them who are moving ahead. And the people of the baby boomer generation will feel better because they know there's a generation coming after them. And they know that the meaning of their lives can be safely entrusted to the work of the younger generation and the grandchildren who will come from them.
So Robert is next, and I just want to announce to the people listening on the World Wide Web that you're listening to a webcast of a live address and discussion with Democratic candidate Lyndon LaRouche, actually the next president of the United States, but you're listening live to a discussion between Mr. LaRouche and members of the audience in Detroit. Robert?
Len Robert Detloff, Washington, D.C. Youth Movement. My question stems from discussions with people in various stratas of society, from people of the so-called wealthy to those of the poor, to students, to politicians, everything from congressmen to state representatives, laborers, union workers. And it seems you find that there's always a feeling or a sense of security within the domain that they're functioning in at that given point in their life, wherever it is. That if I maintain this present course of action, I'll be secure. The other guy might suffer, but my own boat is intact. My own room on the ship is sealed off from the rest of the ship. So, in the light that obviously that pragmatism and that way of thinking is not security, and that security obviously stems from something that is the difference between man and beast, can you elaborate on what that is to give people a better sense of what security really is?
Security lies in yourself, and the way it is done, that's why this youth movement, why this 18 to 25 working group of self-mutual education is so important. You see, the crucial thing is not really what you can know yourself. You pose the question, can you cause what you know to be replicated in the mind of another person? Now, so therefore, the second aspect of being human is not merely the individual mind's ability to see the laws of the universe as an individual observer intervening in the universe, but how do we as society interact with one another to cooperate in bringing about the application of these principles that we require as our benefits, our benefits. Therefore, if you can cause another person, as in dialogue, as in, say, you've got a bunch of young people are batting it around about, like, the Gauss question, which is still troublesome for many. Huh? And as one gets the idea and tries to communicate the idea to another, there's an interchange. And then there's a process of affirmation where they are able to affirm to one another and demonstrate that they actually do understand the same idea of principle and are able to give examples of application, which shows they really know what they're talking about and they mean the same thing. So that when you get to that point where you're able to communicate ideas and to affirm them as being valid by replicating them in relations with others and think of practical applications which show that you both have understood a principle which is right, which works, then you have a sense of identity, a personal identity as a human being, because you know that what you believe about yourself is true. About the powers of your mind, you believe it's true. And that gives you the kind of confidence in which life is built. If you take the same questions and you take them out into social practice generally, in society, and you see people on the streets who don't know this, who don't have a secure sense of what truth is, who don't have a secure sense of personal identity, who depend like a so-called other-directed type of borrowing their identity in the favorable opinion of them by others. And therefore, they are controlled by what they think other people think about them. And the first thing is to be free of being dependent upon what you think other people think about you. It's what you're able to think about yourself and know it's true that's important. But this occurs only through a social process in which you're able to collaborate with people and discover that you really do discover the same things. They are practical. You understand one another, and now you understand yourself because you now can see the inside of yourself through the eyes of other people in this kind of social relationship. And that's why I insisted upon this particular form of the youth movement. It has to be a minimum of 18 to 25 people involved in these kinds of groups. The same kind of thing that's recommended for a high school classroom or for a college classroom. Not mass classrooms. They stink. Lecture hall's fine. They have a function. But the actual dirty work of education occurs in the small classroom, not more than 18 to 25 people, more or less than that, because it's large enough to provoke interaction, and it's small enough that everybody has a chance to participate. And that's what we're trying to do. It's this method, and if you understand it as a method, which should be what happens in schools from primary grades. Good teaching and good would do exactly that. A school should do that. You should never, as I tell people, you should never test anybody with a multiple choice questionnaire. You should throw the teacher out and flunk the teacher if they give it, and flunk the school if they order it. What I would do, say on an advanced level, as I told people many times, and I've done it, at the end of a semester, you give a questionnaire for 3 hours to work it out. 5 questions of which you can select 3 of your choice. These questions will require you to consider things you have not considered up to now, but which you have learned, what you've learned, should have prepared you to attack and see a solution to the problem. And that is the best way to test the teacher. Has the teacher of the class been able to communicate to the students a basis of knowledge in which you can give them 5 questions which they've never faced before in a classroom setting? Let them choose 3 and work them out within that 3-hour period. If they can succeed in approximating a good answer, then the teacher of the course has succeeded. And it's the same kind of principle which should prevail, the same approach, the same concept should prevail in all education and should prevail in every form of education, including social communication in general.
Okay, it looks like our next question, unless you have some more, Bob, coming up, is from Matthew Goodwin, who was, I might tell you, he was in India during World War II.
Very proud and glad to see you, Mr. LaRouche. As you know, I was there in India while you were there in 1943 and 44, and people was making less than 10 cents a day picking tea. I was there when Mahatma Gandhi buried himself for 7 days trying to get his people to come together and not to fight British people with rocks and sticks. They had to fight nonviolent. And I have a couple of questions and 2 comments. I want to know the difference between democracy and the way this world is going today, which is what you call it when the rich get rich and the poor get poor. All right, I'll think of it in a minute. But jobs and health. My son was born in England, and I did not have to buy any milk, juices, and little baby things for several months, 8 months or more in England. Most of the world has free Medicare, even in Poland, and there are the other places that you, I'm sure you know of. And here, it's so hard and so rough to get health care for elder people and the most sick people. My neighbor I take to the hospital in a different place every week that has been operated on, and it costs so much money. Most people that are poor can't even get in the hospitals unless they got insurance. What is it going to take for us to get Medicare in this country? And the difference between democracy and not fascism. Fascism, no, not it's not that. It's capitalism. Democracy and capitalism. All right.
Okay. Now, first of all, you're a veteran. Okay, therefore you should be able to get through the veterans' hospital system, the care that's coming to you as a veteran.
That's right.
You should. Should be able to.
Sure, that's right.
Now let's look at what reform I'm going to make, as I declared this before. On the first hour, I'm in the White House. Number one, D.C. General Hospital reopened as a public hospital, full-service public hospital. And this, of course, affects all of Washington, D.C., but affects especially the poor around Washington, D.C. People are being killed by the shutting down of D.C. General Hospital.
That's right.
Fine. You have the same kind of problem in other parts of the country. Now, what is a reasonable health care policy? First of all, a Hill-Burton policy, which we had until 1973 in the post-war period. We also had functioning veterans' hospitals until we began to cut them out in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So that you had veterans' hospital extension services and so forth around the country. Also, you had the veterans' care through the public health service, which would acknowledge the fact that you were a veteran, and therefore, if there wasn't a veterans' hospital there, you could get the service through the public health service. But what we're going to do is this. We're going to go back to Hilbert. It's going to be a job because we've destroyed many of the health facilities we had, which have been destroyed by the HMO system. It's going to be put back. It's very simple. It's take a few pages of legislation, which I can submit to the Congress. And if we have won the election, which means we will have won the House of Representatives, if the president wins, the president will carry the majority of the House of Representatives on his coattails. He will also carry a great number of the people of the third of the Senate being reelected at that same time. He will also, if he acts quickly, will have an authority during the first days in office, and it has to start right from the first hour of the first day, which he establishes his relationship to the American people as a president. My particular act is that, the health care question. Because the people of America do not trust their government, largely because of health care questions. You can't trust your government if you can't trust it with your life. So therefore, the restoration that means, we go back to a system where we're committed to provide full health care as Hill-Burton did. What we do is we've got to put the doctors back to work. A lot of them have been put out of work by malpractice insurance charges. That has to be controlled. We can't put the doctors out of business. We have put many out of business with malpractice insurance fees. They couldn't afford to practice. Or they've quit areas of practice, which are essential, because they're considered high risk and they couldn't afford the insurance fees. All right, so we're going to have to put them back to work. But we're going to have a system under which a person falls down in the street or needs care. And it used to be that in New York City they would say, call a cop. And then the police would call the ambulance, the guy would be taken to the nearest emergency center, trauma center, I guess they call them today, and the person would be treated in an emergency center, or what we call a trauma center. Then the person, once they've been treated, will require post-emergency care, or at least after trauma observation. So you put them into a bed someplace, a hospital bed. You may then transfer them to a hospital from this temporary place. Now, about that time, somebody would have walked in and said, who's going to pay for all this? If the person had the means, didn't have insurance, they would pay for it up to a certain point, where it became one of these catastrophe cases. Or they might have Blue Cross or Blue Shield or some other kind of insurance that would cover it. But then you might get down to the bottom of the line, this person had no means to pay for much of anything of the care or provide the medication that the person would need. What do? You provide it anyway. Therefore, you don't need elaborate health care schemes. Tell Hillary Clinton to get out of the way. We know how to provide health care. We don't need a dictionary to define a law on health care. The point is, those who need treatment shall be cared for. The public health shall be defended. Those who can afford to pay will pay insofar as they can afford to pay. We will build up our hospitals, our public hospitals, our private hospitals, voluntary hospitals. We'll build up our clinics. We'll build up our medical practice. We will allow the physician to decide, and nobody else, what care the patient requires. If the patient does not like what one doctor recommends, the patient will have a right to go to another physician to get a comparative second opinion, or even a third. This person is going to be treated and treated properly. Now, instead of trying to figure out who's going to pay how much on what fee and so forth, let's cut it out. Let's say that there are contributory and other kinds of health care plans which may work. Okay, fine. But in the case it doesn't work, they're still going to be cared for. And it's cheaper to do it that way by eliminating all that needless paperwork and computer work by a bunch of idiots where accountants are practicing medicine rather than physicians. It's cheaper. It was cheaper before. Now, on the question of democracy and the question of capitalism, well, they're very simple. You have two aspects of a national economy. Most people don't know either one, but I'll explain the two of them to you. Number one is we have all of the territory and all of the people. That is, there's no private involved in that. All of the territory and all of the people, regardless. So therefore, the first thing we have to be concerned with is the infrastructure. The infrastructure of transportation, mass transportation, water management, power generation and distribution, education, general health care, and so forth. These are things that are required which no particular private interest is responsible for. Who's responsible? The government. Who's the government? The government is the national government, the government is the state government, the government is the municipal government, or the equivalent, or the county government. So each in a division of labor, which is traditional for our system of government, will take its traditional area of responsibility for these kinds of things. Basic economic infrastructure, such as education, local health care, sanitation, things of that sort, which are traditionally belong to the local community, which are supported, the local communities are supported and assisted by the states. The states are supported and assisted by the federal government, which is the only agency which has a real power legally to create credit. So if we need to create credit, we will create it with the federal government under federal control. We will supply the credit through private banks or through the local state governments or local governments to wherever it's needed. Therefore, we will develop a national infrastructure which determines the structure within which production and other things occur. Then we will make laws which encourage useful forms of investment. Now, investment means not money, though it does involve money, but it does not mean money as such. Investment is physical. For example, China is building a large water system, including the Three Gorges Dam and other things. These are investments, physical investments, which have a physical capital life cycle of 25 to 50 years. In other words, you're investing for something which you will use up or have to replace over the course of 25 to 50 years. National rail systems are of the same character. Power systems, power generation and distribution systems, are instances of a generation or two generations. So therefore, you invest for one or two generations. Now, you can divide some of this between government investment and private investment. If it's private investment, you either have federal laws. If it involves states, then you have a cooperation between the federal government and the state governments. We used to create public utilities under Roosevelt. You had a public utility, say a power station. The public utility was created for that area. It was regulated. People could invest their savings in these public utilities with relative impunity. People who could not afford to take big risks could invest at a low yield, but secure savings for their old age or contingencies or whatever. They could invest in these things. We created these facilities, and we recycled savings, encouraged people to save, so forth. Bank regulation. We want low interest rate. We want a basic interest rate of 1-2% interest rate throughout the nation. That way, people can invest. We want investment tax credits. For people who invest in creating useful industries, we want them to get a benefit of investing in making that business rather than taking it out and spending it all at once on things like drugs or whatnot, fast women or whatever. So that sort of thing. So you have these two aspects. You have the relationship between the federal, state, and local governments as one integral unit, responsible for the total territory of the land. And then you have the private sector. Now, why do you want the private sector? The private sector is characteristic of human beings as opposed to monkeys. See, in monkeys, you don't want a private sector. That's where the Soviet system made a big mistake. You want the individual entrepreneur who uses his or her mind to make innovations which are useful for humanity, like the machine tool, an engineer or tradesman who goes into a machine tool shop and develops a machine tool business of usefulness, using his ingenuity and that of his associates in that firm. You want people working in those firms who are contributing their ingenuity, their personal ingenuity, to making things better, designing things better. So therefore, we encourage the private sector of individual entrepreneurial type and similar activity as much as possible. That's where the creativity will tend to come from universities and from this part of this private sector. So we have a division of labor between the public sector, which involves about 50% of the total economy of any well-managed economy, the state sector. If you want to privatize the entire economy, you're an idiot, as George Bush does. What you want is a private sector which, unlike the present incumbent president of the United States, is able to think.
Okay, the next question is from Billy Smith.
How you doing, Mr. LaRouche? My name is Billy Smith, and I have a question for you. Now, I go to a community college out in Dearborn, Henry Ford Community College, and some of the things that we've been taught was that some of the information that we have is wrong as far as what we've been taught in elementary and middle school, as far as, you know, gravity being acceleration and not a force. I would like to know, how would you go about changing the educational system, and how would you go about changing the transportation system? Because Michigan has one of the worst transportation systems in the country.
Or somebody did. But no, the educational system is what I've described earlier with this youth movement operation. I've gone at the core of this thing. The essential thing is, you are a human being. You're not a monkey. Therefore, we're not going to give you monkey training courses. We're not going to give you multiple choice questionnaires. We're going to give you the experience of working with other students and educators to work through the process of making original discoveries, even discoveries that were made before you, but you're going to reenact the act of making the discovery. Now it's not a question of your opinion, it's a question of what you know. Right? What is being generally taught in schools today is bunk. We know that. We start from that. Many of the teachers are miseducated. They were miseducated. What age are they? They're baby boomers. Therefore, most of them were miseducated because there were changes in education, beginning with the new math, for example, at the end of the 1950s, which began to destroy education in the United States. Teachers were told they were going to work harder. They weren't going to have the preparation time. In a good school, for example, a teacher would have probably, in the middle school or high school, they would have probably 3 hours of classroom work to 2 hours of preparation work. Teachers would have sabbaticals under which they would go off for further education. They would be paid to take another year of education here or there. They would sometimes be sent, for example, if they were teaching French, they would be sent to France for a year to study the French language in France. Or they would be sent to Germany to study German, or Italy to study Italian, and so forth. And they would come back, therefore, enriched in their ability to communicate with their students. And the preparation time is crucial. The lesson plan is crucial. And it should not be a blab course where you learn to pass a prepared examination. It's a case in which the student is showing comprehension of the material you're trying to get across to them by working it through themselves. And you're getting interplay among the students because the students are most important in education. They educate each other. Look at our young people, like the young people 18 to 25. How many hours a day are they active? They're acting like the best university in the world. They spend a couple hours on this, a couple hours on this, a couple of hours on this, and a couple hours on that. And it adds up to 12, 18 hours a day. They're doing all kinds of things. They're working until they drop. They enjoy it. It's typical good students. Because they're enjoying what they're doing. And they have a sense that they don't want to learn just one thing, they want to learn everything. They have an omnivorous appetite for knowledge. They're learning music. We're teaching them music. They're learning to sing, which is something people can't do in this society anymore. Michael Jackson destroyed the ability of people to sing. It's his worst crime. Boys is another thing. So this is the kind of thing that's required. And therefore, as we said in response to an earlier question, you know you're getting a good education when you know it for yourself. When you know you have a good education. When you know you're having that kind of experience. And when you realize that there is no upper limit to what you might achieve. You know, it's funny. I've seen people, young people, who come from the most atrocious personal circumstances. You would think from their life background they would never make it in life. But some of these people have become some of our most useful geniuses. Somehow or other, they luckily catch on to how the game works, and they become very productive minds. But for the rest of us who are not these accidental or seemingly accidental geniuses, we have to go at it the hard way. We have to develop a system of education which encourages us to develop this kind of creativity. And with the idea, there's no upper limit to what you may require of yourself. It's just making the next step up is all that's required.
What we're going to do is we're going to take two more questions. The next question is from Nathaniel Smith. Is that person still here? Okay. And that will be followed by Nancy Jaber's question.
Hello. My name is Nathaniel Smith. I'm precinct delegate for the 14th Congressional Congress. I have a couple questions I'd like to ask on the positive maker. As the next elected president of the people, by the people, and for the people, what would you do to stop the situation currently in Iraq from turning into another Vietnam? I myself am a Vietnam veteran, 101st Airborne Division. And how soon would it be before you would actually send our troops home? That's the first question. Second question is, as president, what would you do to stop the flow of our jobs currently being subcontracted to other countries, so, such in the area of telecommunications and other things, thereby right now creating massive unemployment in our cities right here? What would you do to curb that? Those are my two questions.
On the question of Iraq, of course, I'm for the immediate withdrawal of the U.S. forces from Iraq. There are several reasons for this. First of all, U.S. troops in Iraq are now absolutely useless because of the crimes that have been committed by our government, that we have lost all credibility in the situation. So I wouldn't want a single American in that area at this time. Therefore, we have to do something about replacing it. Now, before Bremer, Paul Bremer, went in there, you had this crowd of neocons around Cheney. At that point, the previous occupying force, the general who was in charge of it earlier, had proposed to employ the Iraqi army as an engineering force for the self-reconstruction of Iraq's economy. That was to hire them and pay them to function as an engineering force. Now, this is about a couple million people. Would then do the work of rebuilding the Iraqi economy, or the principal amount of work. They got rid of them, dumped them. We could have come out clean. They dumped them. And when they dumped them and put Bremer in with the other mandate, for a bunch of corrupt swine who took that thing over and wanted to steal, that's all they wanted to do, we created a situation which has now led to asymmetric warfare in Iraq. You have over 2 million people in Iraq who are trained as experienced, trained soldiers. They know how to fight all kinds of war, of so-called conventional war, including irregular warfare. What you're seeing in Iraq now is asymmetric warfare, precisely analogous to what happened in Vietnam, is the form of warfare which will increase with each step of folly by the United States government. So nothing being proposed now is going to work. However, if I'm president, first of all, I could get by with it because I would be trusted by the Arab world. I'm the only American political figure running for president who would be trusted by the American world, who would respect my word as trustworthy, one way or the other. No other political figure of the United States would be as a candidate would be trusted, period. So I could do things. Now, what I would do, and what I would have done now, I go to our friends in Europe, in particular, and our friends in the Arab world around Iraq, especially Egypt, Syria, and so forth. And I would propose that through the United Nations Security Council, we establish the arrangements under which Iraq is restored as a nation, rebuilt as a nation, chiefly with Iraqi labor and whatever facilities are required to assist them. This be taken over by people who are not the United States, because I don't think we should be there. Our very presence there is going to incite reaction from the hatred we have incurred by the way we've handled the situation since 1991. So my job is to get us out of there. Now, how'd you get them out there? My withdrawal plan is very simple. Can we get them all out overnight? Physically, no. You have to move them. How do you move them? What you do is your policy says you're going to withdraw your troops into certain areas of concentration for withdrawal. So you pick these territories and you're little hedgehogs and you begin to fly the troops out. And the other forces, whoever come in to assist the Iraqis, will replace them. So effectively, on the day the orders are given, they will be effectively on the way out. The order will be to leave, and it will be as rapidly as possible. They will be withdraw to positions which are predetermined as places of concentration, and they will be removed
as units. And the other nations will take over responsibility. By getting clear of this situation, getting out of the mess we created, we will then free us to deal with other problems in other parts of the world. If I do it, this will simply increase the confidence of the other parts of the world in my presidency. And the benefits we will get from that will be tremendous. We're going back to be respected and loved again as a nation. Otherwise, I mean, No, this is not going to happen in this country. We're not going to export jobs. What we're going to do is we're going to go back to a protectionist system of the type we had before deregulation, before 1971. We are going to protect our jobs. That does not mean we're going to fight trade wars with other countries. It means that if somebody is going to invest in the United States in a manufacturing facility we need, or something else we need, and this person has to make a capital investment or employ people at a certain wage level to get that job done properly, that job is going to be protected by trade policy. It's going to be protected by U.S. financial policy, by credit policy bearing on the banking system. The United States government will obviously have to create a fund. The fund will be loaned through a bank or banking system. This will be earmarked funds of the type that Kennedy was talking about in terms of his investment tax credit. In other words, if a manufacturer who's credible, the banker thinks is credible, the French think is credible, we think is credible, wants to invest in a certain kind of development, we will encourage that. We will put up some of the funds through U.S. credit that this man can borrow to help him get started on this new venture. You know? We will surround that with protection on wage rates. We will raise the minimum wage rate in the United States. Because we have to have a minimum wage rate at which people can live. That's simple. We will make that possible by protectionist policies, which protect the level of wages paid in the United States. It will be a reverse of what Walmart has done. We are also going to have to say, look at our requirements, for example, in infrastructure, which will be our big driver in this area. We need an energy investment, so-called energy investments. We need, over the next 25 years, we need trillions of dollars invested in production and distribution of power. We need a comparable amount in large-scale water management. We have the western United States, which has never been developed in terms of water management. We have North Dakota, which used to be able to grow a crop once in 7 years, not six lean years, but not one lean year, but six lean years. And when the rain came, the farmers could make a profit. The rest of the time, they would tend to go bankrupt. So we would develop this part of the country, which is particularly beyond the 20-inch rainfall line, toward the coastal range, the so-called Great American Desert and its boundaries, and develop it as an area for new cities, new development, done in cooperation with Canada, if they would agree, and with Mexico. And we develop the United States in this way. And we develop our school system, our hospital, our health care systems. We develop the essential infrastructure of the United States, a transportation system. Oh, for example, let's take Detroit. Detroit's interesting. I was just in St. Louis. Now, St. Louis has had a Detroit-style catastrophe, probably worse than that. They've lost the aircraft industry, which used to be centered around there, McDonnell Douglas and so forth. It used to be a hub center for air transport. It's dying. Now, it has, in that area, the potential of that kind of manufacturing. Well, the United States has lost its rail system. I intend to give it back, its general trunk rail system. Now, when we built the transcontinental system, which unified this nation as one nation from Atlantic to Pacific, we started from St. Louis. And we built a rail system, or a complex of rail system, out of the St. Louis hub, which used to be a hub for the wagon trains before then. So we built that. Now we're going to have to build a high-speed transport system for freight and passengers from a hub located in St. Louis to the West Coast. We'll go through the north, middle, and the south, as we always did before. But this time, it would be magnetic levitation, not necessarily the one that's used in Germany, but the best magnetic levitation system we can devise based on the experience of other countries. We developed in the United States. We would use St. Louis as assembly point for development of this system. Now, let's go to Detroit. What do we do here? We have an automobile industry which has outlived its usefulness in its present form. Okay? So therefore, now we have to take the production capability of Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, and use that productive potential before we lose it altogether in devising a new variety of product required. Well, what can Detroit do? The area used to have engineering facilities, machine tool capabilities. It was not the automobile manufacturers that were central to the industry, it was the machine tools vendors who supplied the components of the system. And this is the area where a lot of the jobs have gone out. We now get imported assemblies from poor countries for automobiles rather than making the components ourselves. You used to be able to go to a store and buy a part, a replacement part for an automobile. You can't do that anymore. You have to buy the whole blasted assembly because the manufacturer doesn't know what's inside it. All they know is what the assembly does in terms of sending up the standards. Maybe three countries overseas have some idea of what's inside that assembly. We don't have it. It's not reliable. So therefore, we have to rebuild that, and we have to orient our production capacity for national priorities, the way we went for the aircraft industry before, the automobile industry before then, and the railroads. So now we need a national transport system which will do all kinds of things. We have too many people using superhighways as parking lots every day. Family life is being wasted on parking lots called superhighways. We have all these crazy toll systems, more toll systems all the time. It's taking a toll of our population. So what we need is we need rapid transit systems as a way of reintegrating and reconstructing our economy. We need a way that people can walk out the front door, walk a short distance, get to some kind of light rail or some other system, and get to their destination without having to go through a traffic jam. So therefore, we have a great need in this country for developing a new national transportation grid which integrates high-speed freight and passenger traffic, which integrates it in terms of local communities, high-speed transit systems to get people off the parking lots called highways in order to make it possible for people to live in a community and have efficient access to their schools, to the place they work, and so forth. We need that. So therefore, this area must be rebuilt. It must be rebuilt based on its existing capabilities, redesigned and applied to a new mission. And the mission is a national transportation system. Automobiles were a transportation system. We also have other kinds of transportation systems. We're going to do it. And by this kind of method, we can address the problem.
So you're listening to a live webcast by Lyndon LaRouche, Democratic presidential candidate. Nancy Jaber will be our final questioner.
All right. Hi, Lynn. I've been actually wrestling with this idea of love as a conceptual object and expressing it as a rational emotion and how this can be developed through classical composition. I was wondering if you can...
...of passion, you see? As I've dealt with this in this article I've written recently, which will be published, I presume, fairly soon. People think of passion as animal passion. And the romanticism, in terms of art, is based on that. A fellow trying to beat his brains out with a drum, for example, a drum beat, is an example of passion. It's not art. It's something else. It's a drug. As a matter of fact, it does have drug-like effects on the brain. So it's not good for your mind, among other things. This constant drum beat. But great art, as great science, evokes a special kind of passion. The passion of discovery. A child who is elated by making a valid discovery of a problem. A little child, suddenly elated by making a discovery, repeating it over and over again because this act of discovery was such a pleasure to that child. That is an act of love. Now, when your relationship with other people has that same characteristic, it's a characteristic of love. When you have a sense of possessing somebody else, that's a relationship between a bull and a cow. It has not love, contrary to what some people believe in Washington. So in any case, the cultivation of the art of loving lies in the development of the personality and never losing the beauty of seeing a young child make a discovery. And where the discovery brings tears of joy to the parents, the witnessing of that child making that discovery. And what happens in our society is that quality is lost along the way. And therefore, people don't have it anymore. The people who are married for a long time, who have not become baby boomers yet, and therefore tend to stay married. I mean, you know, it's, marriage is the anteroom of boredom for the baby boomer. Don't change the baby, you change your spouse. But the actual loving with older people, in older couples, comes with this sense of the joys that they share. And the joys have the same quality of passion that you have with where parents have tears of joy in seeing a child make an actual discovery as a child. And what we miss in society is we often lose the sense of what passion is, good passion is, healthy passion is. And passion is a sense of lovingness toward mankind, toward solving problems, toward seeing children develop, seeing the poor get out of poverty, seeing a beautiful community emerge from a slum. These are acts of love. And this is what is important. And people should not search for some other kind of love. They should concentrate on searching for that kind of love. And if you have to wait to find it, it's well worth the wait.
Thank you.